So is it okay while you're taping if people ask questions?
Absolutely.
I brought a few slides to show, but not enough to keep us, you know, occupied for very long. So, you know, if you guys don't talk, it'll be a short, I mean, I'm hoping you will talk.
Interrupting
when I'm doing that, just so you make a conversation out of it. That would be, yeah, good. All right. Well, I brought some things to show you that I thought you might be interested in hearing about how the climate works. And to start with, I have this this free online version of my class for English majors down at Chicago that is on Coursera.org. So it's running all the time. You can sign up for it for free, and there's little videotape lectures, and you can play with models and answer questions and things like that. And so far, something like 50,000 people have signed up for this class, and about 7% of them have actually finished, which is, I guess, sort of standard for these kind of free classes. So, you know, if you want more, that's one place. So this is the kind of chaotic outline that I put together to show you. And it's kind of, some unrelated kind of things kind of next to each other. So first, I wanted to talk about the different kinds of greenhouse gases, methane versus carbon dioxide. And then talk about kind of where we are with the with changes in the climate. Paris Agreement is to try to limit the peak temperature that the Earth ever gets to, so I'll talk about that and what it means. Talk about ice sheets and sea level, like you asked, and then kind of some stuff about kind of where I think sort of we are. So to start out with CO2 and methane, this is a plot that shows the global average temperature. So this is in the past, and then these are projections into the future. And the green line is business as usual. So, you know, no measures to abate releasing any of these gases. Here, this purple line is measures to cut carbon dioxide emissions. And what I'm going to show you now is that carbon dioxide kind of accumulates when we release it. It doesn't really go away. Whereas methane is a transient gas that lasts for about 10 years, and then it goes away to CO2, actually. So because CO2 accumulates, if we try to stop emitting it so much, it takes a while for the kind of accumulated history of how much we've emitted to kind of sink in. So it takes a while for this curve to sort of peel off. This one here is what they project if they took all kinds of measures to cut methane emissions. And because methane, the average methane in the atmosphere is only 10 years old, because that's how long it lasts, if you change how much it's emitted, it changes the methane concentration pretty quickly. And then adding the CO2 measures and the methane measures together, you get this pink curve, which, you know, looks the nicest of all of them. And we've got these different temperature limits. 2 degrees C was the limit that everybody talked about before Paris. In fact, I gave an exam the week of the Paris negotiations, and I asked the question, what is the target that everybody's talking about? And I was looking for 2 degrees C. And then, like, between when I gave the exam and when I graded it, the news came from Paris that they went for 1.5 degrees. I was just floored and ecstatic. And I gave them credit for 2 degrees in total magnet. So here's what CO2 and methane are actually doing. CO2 is kind of rising steadily. And methane is kind of, it's trying to, but it's sort of concave the other way. And this is because this is just accumulating, whereas methane is a transient gas. So the way they kind of work is like CO2 acts like an odometer that records how far you've gone, whereas methane is like a speedometer, which records how fast you're emitting the methane. So if you want to get the methane concentration to go up, you have to emit it faster and faster and faster to make the speedometer go faster. But if you want the CO2 to go up, you just have to keep emitting it, and it just accumulates. And so, yeah.
Very good question. Are those two gases at are they aggregating? Meaning, like, if, let's say, we would stop methane, right, which is mostly, I would say, like, the cows and, right, so...
Yeah, rice paddies and...
But let's say CO2, right? Would that then slow down of that whole pickup, or would that still stay on the same, you know, race level as it is now?
You mean the concentration in the air?
Yeah, what is the, like...
How much does the oxidation of the methane contribute to the level of the CO2?
CO2 or vice versa, meaning if those two are actually accumulating, like if it speeds up, if those two accumulate together, or is it still just the separate, functions of,
Yeah, well, CO2 just sort of stays CO2, but methane gets turned into CO2 after about 10 years. But we're emitting CO2 at a rate of about 100 times what we're emitting methane.
But methane, so adds up. In the end, it does add up to the CO2.
It does turn into CO2. Yeah, it turns into CO2. While it's methane, it's particularly powerful as a greenhouse gas, but then it turns into CO2, and then it's just the same as all the rest of the CO2.
So, even if when it's like spread, like after 10 years, right? You said the longevity of the methane, right?
Then it turns into CO2.
So then it doesn't actually disappear. It turns into CO2.
Yeah, that's right. So it's kind of like releasing some kind of supercharged CO2 that gives you an extra boost of energy of warming before it turns into CO2. So this next graph shows you a sort of nonlinear effect of how much gas you have. It turns out that if you don't have much gas, you add a little bit, and it makes a huge change to the energy balance of the planet, the watts per square meter of energy that gets trapped. So you add a little, and you get a huge change, and then you have more and more, and you add more, and you still get a change, but it shallows out a lot. It never goes totally flat. It never gets to the point where it won't affect the climate anymore, but it gets less sensitive. So CO2, the concentration is about here. So how much the climate changes when you add CO2 depends on sort of the slope of that line. Whereas methane, the concentration is way down here, and so it's got a much steeper dependence here because there's just less methane there. This is called the band saturation effect. So band means some kind of infrared light, like a frequency band. And then saturation means you use up all the infrared, and so it doesn't matter if you put more gas there. So if you put these things together, the sort of longevity and the forcing and everything, and then we look back at this plot, I mean, the conclusion that leaps out at you is we got to deal with both methane and CO2 in order to avoid warming too much. And I totally get that, and I agree with that. But one thing that's kind of deceptive is that the methane that they're worried about in sort of the year 2050 to keep the peak temperature down, that's methane that was emitted in like 2045. That's not methane that we emit today. So what happens a lot is you see, where did that plot go? This one. Because methane is more powerful, it's like 40 times more powerful than CO2, you see people sort of weighing, like fracking. Fracking saves, you don't have to burn coal, so it cuts down on CO2 emissions, if that's true. But it has methane leaking, so is that, you know, how do you weigh those things? And my opinion, people tend to overweigh methane because, you know, it's more powerful right now, but now isn't the crisis. The crisis is 2050. So I have a colleague of mine who wrote a review paper on this, and he said that cutting CO2 emissions now is like saving money for your retirement, whereas cutting methane emissions now is like saving bananas for your retirement. That's, you know, only good if you're going to retire like real soon, because bananas don't keep, right? There's a little climatology humor there. So I wrote this kind of tongue-in-cheek thing for a blog called Real Climate, and it was the series of pie charts that was sort of making fun of all the people who were like really concerned about methane, the importance of methane in the climate system today. So how much has CO2 versus methane changed the radiative of forcing in the past 30 years? You see it's mostly CO2. Methane is sort of important, but it's not the main thing. And then how much is going to affect the climate, how much of what we emit today is going to affect the climate in 30 years, it's all CO2, because methane doesn't last that long. So the importance, well, yeah, if we keep emitting it, then it will be there. But the methane we're emitting now, yeah.
Isn't the melting of the ice at both of the poles like letting methane loose and increasing the amount of methane?
Well, there is concern about thawing permafrost, because there's a lot of, you know, like old plant material that was preserved because it was frozen. And when it thaws, even though it's been frozen for tens of thousands of years, there are bacteria living there waiting to start chomping as soon as it thaws. And so the carbon can get oxidized to CO2, or if it's waterlogged and soggy and anaerobic, then it, some of it can come out as methane.
Yeah, I mean, it's also a natural process, like the air and the crust and everything emits methane, CO2 by itself, right?
You're exactly right, that the important thing is the total rate at which methane is being added to the atmosphere. And so we can figure out whether the Arctic is really important or not by looking at the sources of methane. So how much does the permafrost release versus the methane hydrates in the ocean versus, you know, cow farts versus rice paddies and things like that. And so the next thing in my little tongue-in-cheek pie chart thing was how important the Arctic Ocean hydrates are in the global methane cycle. So hydrates are this frozen water that has, it's like soccer ball cages of water molecules, and then it has gas molecule inside. So on Mars, there are CO2 hydrates, and on Earth, there just happen to be lots of methane hydrates in sediments of the ocean. So if you look at where the methane is coming from to the global atmosphere, this is what's coming from the Arctic, and this is coming from everywhere else. Most of the methane is coming from the tropics, from tropical wetlands and from, you know, human emissions not in the Arctic. So the Arctic actually is not all that important in the methane cycle. And then if you look at the methane from the Arctic, where it's coming from, there's the ocean hydrates. So this is the thing that people are all hysterical about. Like, this is the tipping point that's going to destroy us all. I just don't get why the Arctic has this special fascination for people who are, you know, afraid of the climate kind of melting down. Why pick on the Arctic? I don't really understand.
This idea, I don't even know if there are some people who believe that. I mean, like I said.
Well, there are scientists who push it.
Mm-hmm. Because they're paid.
Because they have to get their grant money, that's right.
I mean, that's exactly what's happening. It was always happening, and it was never the problem like it is nowadays, right? So there has to be an additional, to the existing emission, right? Because we're starting to experience the changes in the climate now, right? It wasn't that... high as now.
Well, we know what the
so
methane...
spiking up pretty quick, right?
Well, okay, I showed you that. And we know about the... here's methane. Whoops. Bah. Here's the methane concentration going back to 1985. And actually, they know what it was going all the way back thousands of years from little bubbles in ice cores. So it's something like twice what it was in the natural state. So that means twice as much emissions. That means we're emitting it as fast as natural, like swamps and things were.
So, yeah. So the whole argument is just invalid.
Well, it's kind of destructive too, because people who are concerned about Earth's climate, if they get the idea that something that we've already passed a tipping point in the Arctic, they get kind of lethargic and they don't care anymore. They give up. You know, whereas, as Neil deGrasse Tyson said in his Cosmos episode on climate change, there is a future worth fighting for, and he's right. So to finish on methane and the Arctic, there is one way in which the Arctic is not sort of insignificant, and that is on the really long term. There's lots of carbon up there. It just takes a long time to come out. So it's very possible that, you know, hundreds of years from now, we will have released a bunch of carbon, and then these frozen stores might sort of add to that that human source of carbon. And so looking at the various sources of carbon that are kind of in play on the planet, there's coal is huge. There's much more coal than oil or gas. Here's all the trees. Here's soil carbon that's not frozen. Here's methane hydrate in the ocean. Huge uncertainty on that one. And then the Arctic, there's permafrost soils and hydrate. And in this case, the Arctic is not negligible. It's got some good fraction of the world's carbon. So that's kind of the story of methane and CO2. Sir?
So aren't a lot of the methane emissions from agriculture eating away at that section of the pie chart that's carbon in soil?
Yeah, maybe. There is.
The methane is carbon that would have been sequestered in the soil if it's coming from like a field.
Well, there's emission from rice paddies. You have methane that comes out whenever it's waterlogged and anaerobic.
Right.
And they grow
rice in organic carbon in the soil that's decomposing. And
that's true.
It's releasing methane.
Yeah.
So that would be eating away at that.
That could be right. Yeah.
What about the meat agriculture? The whole,
cow farts. It's actually
farms.
They exhale. It's not actually farts.
Yes.
The ruminant animals.
Of the cows, right?
All ruminant animals emit methane. To varying degrees, there are different chemistries of different kinds of sheep or cows or something. So New Zealand, their main contribution to global warming is methane from their sheep, but they can just raise different kinds of sheep that don't, fart as much and kind of deal with that. It's not negligible. There's also methane that comes from termites, which is, I guess, a natural source.
And from dams.
Pardon me?
From the power pools behind these mega dams. Also.
Yeah, when you waterlog something, it gets anaerobic and can release methane. And fracking also releases methane. Okay, so the next part is about so we got methane, we got CO2. I'm telling you, we got to watch out for the CO2. Methane, for now, is a distraction. So what about the CO2? It turns out, so one thing is that The climate change you get from releasing CO2, I showed you earlier, is a non-linear function. It doesn't go straight. The energy imbalance, which leads to the temperature, it's really sensitive, and then it gets sort of less sensitive. But there's another non-linearity in the carbon system, which governs how much of the CO2 released dissolves in the ocean. Because as we put more CO2 into the ocean, it changes the chemistry of the ocean, and then the ocean doesn't want to take as much CO2 next time. Because you sort of use up the capacity of the ocean to absorb CO2. So the one thing is sort of you add CO2 and the temperature would, kind of plateau like that. But the other, you add CO2 and more of it stays in the atmosphere. So those things kind of cancel each other out. So what you get is basically a straight line relationship between how much carbon you have ever released, and it doesn't matter whether you do it quickly or slowly. It's all the, it, you, you reach the same peak temperature from releasing that carbon. So it's like a big pie that, we can eat it. The more we eat, the sicker we will feel, and we'll feel sicker forever. But it's not like we can eat it slowly and avoid the sickness. It's like an arsenic pie or something. So where we are now is sort of here. We've burned about 300 gigatons of fossil fuels, and we've cut down 200 gigatons of trees. So that's about 500 gigatons. And that has led to a temperature that's about 1 degree centigrade warmer than it would have been if we hadn't done that. So the pre-Paris target was peak temperature of 2 degrees C. And I always felt that was more to do with what people thought was attainable than what would actually be like a safety limit. It's like if you hired some engineers to design you a bridge, they said, well, you can't afford a safe bridge, so well, you build this bridge, and it's not really all that safe, but that's what you want. And then, so I was ecstatic when I read the news in Paris that they're pushing for 1.5 degrees. So 2 degrees is warmer than the Earth has been since humans were a species, probably. 1.5 is, a lot closer to where we are than 2. So, I really feel like 1.5, while it's much harder to attain, is at least a realistic, this is something to try really hard not to go past. So when you burn fuels and release the CO2 to the atmosphere, it just kind of accumulates in the atmosphere and ocean kind of system. If the ocean was infinitely big, maybe all the CO2 would dissolve in the oceans, but it doesn't. All the carbon reservoirs kind of get fatter on this carbon that we release. And so what happens is the CO2 goes up, and there's a little bit of a peak, right? You know, this is assuming that we stop emitting at some point, which some days feels optimistic. But so after that happens, it kind of sinks back down, but it kind of settles into a new plateau. It doesn't go back to what it was before. And this time axis here goes to 10,000 years into the future. So this is like 20,000 years in the past. So here's the last ice age. Here's the Holocene, the interglacial time, which is the, you know, so agriculture was invented right about here. This is the this sort of nice stable climate we've been in for you know, as long as we have had like writing and all of that. And then this is going forward. And then here are the temperature impacts of that. So the smallest thing here is 1,280 gigatons, so a little more than the 1,000 that I said would take us to 2 degrees. And here's the temperature. It peaks at about 2 degrees. It stays there for 10,000 years, for actually like more like 100,000 years. But they got bored plotting it, so they just cut it off at 10,000. So if the climate change is going to last that long, now you've suddenly got ice sheets in play, because it takes a long time to melt an ice sheet. So there are different kinds of ice on the planet. There's sea ice that's floating, that's just, you know, a meter or a couple meters, and that melts very quickly. Actually, the sea ice in the Arctic has been collapsing in a really frighteningly dramatic way in the past years. There are small mountain glaciers like in Alaska or Patagonia or, you know, the Andes or something. And those have a response time of sort of 10 years to 100 years or something like that. So there are big glaciers that have been melting back for since the end of the Little Ice Age in like the year 1750. And they're still kind of melting back from that, and now they're melting from the warming of climate since then. But then the big players are the big ice sheets on Greenland and even bigger on Antarctica. And these things are so big that they have a melting time scale which, according to the models anyway, which are clearly too sluggish, they have a melting time scale of a few thousand years. So this is a plot, and it shows sea level on this axis and global average temperature there. And right here is the forecast for the year 2100 from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, this United Nations organized group of scientists that write these reports every 5 years. Something like 3 degrees of warming and maybe 1 meter of sea level rise, which this axis goes from plus 100 down to minus 150, so it doesn't look, you know, very much different from zero. And then the dark points are reconstructed temperatures and sea levels from times in the past. So here's the last ice age when it was about 6 degrees colder than today, and there was a mile of ice over our heads right here in Chicago, the Laurentide Ice Sheet, and sea level was like 120 meters lower. And then here's the last interglacial time, and here's the Pliocene, which is 3 million years ago before Greenland ice sheet was a thing. And then here's an example of sort of a hothouse climate when there was no ice on the planet at all, which is actually the way the planet usually works in the past. The times like ours when there are ice sheets are relatively rare. So the thing that jumps out here is that this white dot is not on the line that's made by the dark dots. And the reason is because the year 2100 it doesn't give time for the ice sheets to respond. It's the wrong time scale to describe the phenomenon. It's our human time scale, and you know, to get a politician to think about the year 2100 is, you know, a triumph in itself, but it's just the tip of the ice sheet. Can I say that? In terms of the actual response of the thing. It's like you see somebody getting ready to jump off of a building and you want to help, so you say, hey, if you jump off of that building in the first half a second, nothing bad will happen to you because it takes you 2 seconds to, you know, hit the ground. It's sort of deceptive the way that is. And there's reasons. So the ice sheet models say it takes sort of 3,000 years to really make a dent in the Greenland ice sheet or something like that. But field glaciologists are discovering all kinds of tricks that are only now being incorporated into the models. And the Hansen paper is one example of this. So one thing that they've discovered is that meltwater, so this is a stream of meltwater on Greenland, and this is where it's just going down. It just kind of is called a moulin, and this thing just does a waterfall and goes down. And so you can lower a graduate student down there to take pictures or something if you want to study it. But it goes all the way down to bedrock. And the ice sheet, the ice is supposed to be colder than freezing. You know, so it was a surprise that it could do this. So the way the models work, the way if you want to melt, if you want to make the ice move faster, you've got to have heat diffuse down through the ice sheet. It takes a long, long time to do that. But here, you know, you get a warm summer and this water goes down there, it lubricates the bed, and it starts to move. So it goes faster in the summer than the winter. It's got a much faster response time than anybody had thought and that the models had predicted. There was another interesting paper that came out this summer about ice sheet modeling, not the Hansen paper, but by some guys named Rob DeCanto and David Pollard, who were sort of state-of-the-art ice modelers. Hansen is not an ice modeler. He's more of a climate guy and an ocean modeler. So one thing that they found makes a big difference in their ice model, and they're trying to, what they're trying to do with this model, which is kind of a new thing, is to actually forecast things like this, the way that sea level changes in the past as a function of different climates. Never been possible to do that before, but one thing they had to add to make that possible is the physics of, if you have a big shelf of ice like this that's sort of floating, you know, it's really thick. It's like 90% under the water, right? But if it's really thick, you're going to have this huge thing that's sticking up. And if it's high enough, it just kind of crumbles. So they added that to their model. If your cliff is too high, then crumble. And that made a significant difference in, you know, hindcasting the sea level variations that they put together and reconstructed. And then the Hansen thing has to do with a feedback that is kind of through the ocean. So what's happening is you have melt that is that's putting fresh water on the surface, and that fresh water is buoyant compared to the salt water, because, you know, salt makes water denser. And so you're stratifying this water here. And normally it would mix, and so warm water that was down here would get mixed with cooler water that's up above. But if you stratify it, then warmer water, you know, it cools down up top and it warms up down below. And so that warmer water, if it can get at this grounding line where the ice is attached to the rock, you can make it melt really fast. Especially if the land is getting, you know, farther, if it's going downhill as you go into the ice sheet. And that happens in particular in Antarctica, because the ice sheet is very old, and if you put something heavy on land, it sort of sinks, like if you're standing on a floating sort of flexible dock on water. You step on it and it kind of sinks down. It's called isostatic equilibration, or rebound is what it's called when it comes up. I don't know what it's called when it goes down, debound or something.
Deflection.
Yeah, right. So what that means is that the West Antarctic ice sheet in particular is sitting in a hole. It's like entirely a marine ice sheet. It's never attached to land that's above sea level. And you could never make that. You couldn't put an ice sheet, you know, on the bottom of the ocean, because ice floats. The only way to do it is to put it there when it was above the sea level, and then it got shoved down. But now that it's there, if you melt this back a little bit, then it's easier, you know, it gets easier and easier for the ice to kind of float up. And so there is a runaway process that has been identified since like the 80s, where if this thing starts to go, it can just keep going. Once you start it, it can keep going. And so there was a report actually last summer from scientists at NASA who identified these glaciers here on West Antarctica, the Thwaites Glacier and the Pine Island Glacier. So what this map is showing is the speed at which the ice is flowing downhill. So it's flowing much faster in a few sort of rivers of ice called ice streams than in, you know, stagnant places like that. But they said that this Thwaites Glacier is already doing this runaway process, probably take hundreds of years. And I looked it up. Just from that glacier, it was like 1.5 meters of sea level right there. So, you know, obviously everybody knows the IPCC thing of 1 meter by 2100 is ridiculously low because the models just don't do all this stuff. So where does this leave us in terms of CO2 emissions if we have a total of a trillion tons that we can release, that's or 1,000 gigatons, to get to 2 degrees C, or, you know, 3/4 of a trillion if we wanted to limit to 1.5 degrees C. That's what we have to do. We've already released, you know, half of this. And so it's as if we had, like, this gigatons a year emissions that were being released all these years. And so we've, you know, we've done, released that stuff. And then if we were to now decide to make cuts at some percent per year, like 2% per year cuts, every year 2% less than the year before, and then you add up all the carbon that was released throughout that whole time, you come in at 1,000 gigatons. So that's what we have to do, is to start ramping down. But if we wait longer, we have to ramp down more quickly. And so you see these curves get kind of sharper and sharper and sharper till by like 2040, we'd have to basically go cold turkey because we would have done the 1,000 gigatons. And so the amount, the cuts per year goes up very steeply kind of the longer we wait. And so if you want to go and cut 20% of the CO2 emissions that we're doing this year by next year, that's a lot of power plants you got to build or something. It costs a lot of money to do that. So the longer we wait, the more it costs. And then the other thing to remember about this is that most of the fossil fuels carbon is coal. There's like 10 times as much coal as there is oil or gas. And so, you know, people are driving past here. You think of that, like, look at this like a geologist, and it's an explosion. I mean, this all these cars driving around burning this gas. But there's not really enough petroleum in the ground to really cook the planet. There's a couple hundred gigatons. And so one way to play it would be to just go cold turkey on coal right now and then burn all the oil that's left, and that would put us at about that right level.
And then what?
And then what?
And then after we burn the oil, then what?
Well, we're going to burn the oil either way. So, you know, whether you care about climate or not, we're going to run out of oil and have to deal with, you know, coming up with an alternative for that. That's not our fault. That's just the way that is. But it seems to me that if we had been dealt a different hand of, you know, geological cards, and we just had no more coal left, it would be totally easy. It would just be a business opportunity. It wouldn't be a challenge whatsoever. We wouldn't have to go back and live like the Flintstones or anything. It would be just, you wouldn't even think about it. Sure. Yeah, we could, if we had no more coal, somebody would come up. My point is that the hard part is just to make the decision. It's not technologically hard. We're a very smart species if there's money involved. So, you know, if we made the decision to just outlaw coal combustion, and the U.S. has a big fraction of the world's coal, and China has a big fraction of the rest of it. And so, you know, and Illinois, in fact, has got a fairly large fraction of our country's coal. So we're sitting on ground zero right here of the fossil fuel thing. Okay, so in terms of what measures could be taken to, you know, solve the problem, there's no single magic bullet that would solve the problem, because we use carbon to light the lights, to heat the place, to run the TV, to drive around. We manufacture with it. It's used in agriculture. It's used in everything. There's CO2 emissions from everything that we do. So we can't just get compact fluorescent light bulbs and have that solve the problem. It takes lots and lots of changes. So the way this was put in this very influential and terrific paper from quite a while ago, 10 years ago now, so this is CO2 emissions, so business as usual is just rising at some like 3% per year. And then this was what they were putting out as a stabilized scenario where the CO2 would be stabilized. So this was before they were talking about temperature targets. This was trying to stabilize it at 500 parts per million. But, you know, whatever, it's a stabilizing thing. And the point is, there's no single change that you can make to get from there to there. So they divided it up into little tiny sections, which start out at zero and then kind of ramp up to like a gigaton per year savings by the year 2050. And the genius of this paper was that they called these little things wedges. And everybody loves to say the word wedge. You know, I met a guy who does wedge analysis for the city of Chicago. You know, it's just a marketing is genius. So here's a list that they published of, which you probably can't read, but it's 15 different possible wedges that are available today using current technology. And to reach their stabilization target that they were pushing for, which is not, you know, adequate to today, you know, what we now think, but they needed 7 of those. So you just, it's like a menu at a restaurant. You could just choose any of them that you want. So for example, more efficient vehicles. They're assuming that we've got like 500 million cars today, and by 2050 they're projecting 2 billion cars. But if they got 60 miles a gallon instead of 30, which is totally doable, that would be a wedge. Windmills, efficient buildings, nuclear power plant, which I'm not into nuclear myself, but it could be a wedge. Windmills could be a wedge. You know, there's just all these different things that are available. So I really think that you know, we have the technology. It's just hard to make a decision. I sort of feel like there's parallels with the abolition movement of slavery. So the people who are passionate about the, you know, ethical unacceptability of slavery were frustrated for decades, and they probably thought it would never ever change. And it wasn't an easy change, obviously. But so the climate thing, you sort of compare to that, slavery has kind of a more immediate, more obvious, you know, victim. You can see exactly who's being harmed. Climate change is sort of more nebulous than that. On the other hand, the weather is getting really weird. And it's getting weirder every year, and it's sort of ratcheting up. So if somebody like Thomas Jefferson was able to, you know, somehow convince his smart brain that it was okay to own 150 slaves, you know, once he got over that cognitive dissonance, he could just kind of live with that, and it wouldn't keep ratcheting up and getting weirder. But the weather is getting weirder and weirder and weirder, and it seems like, you know, the institutions that sort of lock us into the whole fossil fuel thing, you know, that's even tippier than the climate system. Social systems are very tippy. So, you know, nobody expected the Berlin Wall to fall, and then it did all of a sudden. So I actually am not as down on the Paris Agreement as you are, Anne. It has no teeth. That's totally true. The agreements, like the Kyoto Protocol, tried to specify, okay, you guys do this and you guys do that, and nobody wanted to do those things. And so what Paris is, it's all totally voluntary. What you're obligated to do if you sign is show up every year and say, we emitted this much CO2 this year, and next year we're going to try to emit only that much. And it's sort of a mechanism of like public shame where, you know, not only can people kind of push their governments, but now governments can kind of push each other. And I sort of feel like that's a mechanism that, as the weather keeps getting weirder and weirder, will provide some way to sort of push through this. And I also am buoyed by reading that the conservative party in this country is like one of the last conservative parties in the whole sort of democracy world that denies the science of climate change. So, you know, it is happening. And I think the Paris Agreement kind of provides a mechanism to move forward. I try to be optimistic. You know, the world is ending. That's just not a good sell. I got to keep a happy face. So to sort of summarize, looking back at the outline, methane versus CO2, my opinion for now, for the next couple of decades, methane is a distraction. Forget about it and worry about CO2. Arctic lakes are not as scary as coal-fired power plants. The peak temperature and the carbon budget, what we got to there is that we're more than halfway to, we're two-thirds of the way to the Paris Agreement target of 1.5 degrees C. The plots I showed of how many cuts per year it takes to get, those were all for a 2 degrees C target. That's out of date. And it could be that to make it to 1.5 degrees C will overshoot and will be required to pull CO2 back out of the atmosphere. That is possible. It just takes energy and a place to put the CO2, and it's phenomenally stupid to release the CO2 to the atmosphere if the plan is to scrub it out again later. But it is possible. It's not like we're destroying the planet and we can't ever, you know, fix it again. Except for ice sheets. We can destroy the ice sheets and we can't fix them again. The ice sheets, what's been going on with the ice sheets just in this last year is really frightening. And it seems like if one of these feedbacks for melting of the ice sheet starts, there would be no real way to stop that. So that does put a real tone of immediate emergency on the thing. But in terms of CO2 emissions, I feel like we could easily stop if we just decided to. And then just last thing, so keep your eye on the ball. The ball is CO2 emissions from coal. So that's what I got.
What would happen if there was no ice in the Arctic at the pole?
The sea ice?
Yeah.
So the sea ice, this is kind of a good example of a tipping point in the climate system, because the sea ice melts very quickly, and when it melts, it allows the ocean to take sunlight. I mean, it's cloudy up there most of the time anyway, but still, there's this thing called the ice albedo feedback, that ice has a high albedo. It's very white and reflective, and if you get rid of it, the energy can be absorbed by the ocean, and so that can change all kinds of things. There's a pressure difference between the Arctic and the equator that drives the jet stream, and there's, because of the melting of the ice, in part because of that, it warms more in the high latitudes than at the equator. It's called high latitude amplification. So there's this temperature difference that's driving the jet stream, but it's becoming less of a temperature difference. And so there's discussion now. I don't know, you know, how this is going to settle out. It's not settled yet. But maybe the jet stream is getting more kind of wavy and loopy than it was before. So the polar vortex winter a couple years ago, or just this, we had a big storm system just a week or two ago, where there was this thing they call an omega block, which dumped like a foot of rainfall on Houston before noon. You know, it broke the record for the record rainfall before it was even lunchtime down in Houston from that. And then there's also the Greenland ice sheet. So if you melt the sea ice, it could be that the, you change the climate enough that you can sort of destabilize that somewhat as well. So the Arctic sea ice is something to be concerned about. A good thing is that if things cooled back down again, the sea ice would form again quickly, as opposed to an ice sheet like Greenland, which takes, you know, tens of thousands of years to grow.
So maybe nuclear winter?
Well, they talk about geoengineering, which is the idea that you could sort of blow smoke up into the stratosphere. So the test for this was Mount Pinatubo, which a volcanic eruption has to be big enough to actually put stuff up in the stratosphere where it doesn't rain out very quickly. You know, if it stays down here, it'll rain out in a couple of weeks, like acid rain kind of from a smokestack. But Pinatubo cooled the planet down by about half a degree for a couple of years after it blew. It was actually a good test for the climate models because they sort of knew, they were able to predict it in advance, and then it did what they thought it was going to. The immediate problem with geoengineering is that it makes the planet kind of more arid because you've got CO2, and that's shining infrared light down, and we want to compensate for that by having less sunlight. But CO2 and sunlight do different things when they come close to the ground. CO2 gets absorbed by water vapor, and it doesn't really reach the ground, whereas the sunlight goes all the way to the ground, and it makes water evaporate. So a geoengineered world would be kind of an arid world, which is kind of a bad thing. But the larger difficulty with geoengineering is just the longevity of the climate impacts from releasing CO2. You can't geoengineer the planet for 100,000 years. That's nuts. And so we'd be sort of leaving, you know, future generations with this obligation to pay their climate bill, or else they would, you know, get clobbered with the whole thing sort of all at once. And that's kind of, there was a book by a famous economist at my university saying that, why should we bother cutting emissions? We can just fix it with geoengineering. And that was like a typical kind of economist kind of a thing, because it's just, it's not a fix. It's like a temporary Band-Aid while you kind of try to fix it better
and
by
also,
removing the CO2.
The companies do, just because they are charged for like over the average above the emissions, right? So they just pay, they would just have to pay a fine for that, and that's it. So for like huge corporations, that's not a problem. Emitting more will, in the end, bring them more money, even with paying those fees. So that's how the whole, I think, mentality, you know, that's how it's flawed. Because it's, in the end, you know, it's not about anything else but the profit, and that's what the corporation...
Well, but we also have laws. Companies aren't allowed to enslave people for profit or murder them for profit. I mean, there are limits where we've decided as a society that we are civilized and we're not going to go there. And so we make laws because, you know, hopefully we're all ethical enough not to do those things anyway, but... You know, that doesn't work. We have to have like laws and jails and things like that to you know, enforce them.
It's in your book about externalities, because laws have to accommodate the economic system that the lawmakers are representing.
Yes.
So, if it's an externality, if you would actually talk about that in relation to states that are involved with the Paris Agreement, for instance, will come around the profit motive, that there some sense in your book you talk about the tragedy of the commons.
Yeah, sure.
I think that's the
problem,
that's
exactly.
Yeah.
Well, but like I say, we pass laws to set limits on those things after, you know, things get out of hand and enough people realize what's going on. We can say stop no more. I mean, it seems like we should recognize that emitting CO2 to the atmosphere from the ground causes harm to others and should just be against law. And it seems like we could get there. And we're not going to get it by individual virtue. It has to be laws, because individuals don't have a virtue when you're competing against each other. But you need laws. You can have laws. Yeah.
You know, the corporation would just be, you know, terminated.
Or a more immediate step would be to you know, put a price on carbon and sort of ratchet the price up and, you know, push the profit motive in a different direction. And that seems like, so British Columbia has that, and you know, even conservatives like a carbon tax. You know, a revenue-neutral carbon tax is less government meddling than, you know, having regulations about what kind of fuel efficiency you can have and things like that. So, you know, once someone who's like, which I'm not politically conservative that way, I love a socialist nanny state, but someone who does feel that way, once they accept this reality of this train wreck of the climate change, that, you know, there are solutions that even they can embrace. I was doing this thing, a web broadcast thing for the Wall Street Journal, and they got me and some guy from the Heartland Institute. And so they started him first and said, you know, Bob, what do you think should be done about the climate crisis? And he said, oh, a carbon, we think a carbon tax. And then, you know, Archer, what do you think? Yeah, that could work. Wait a second, we're supposed to be fighting here.
I think you mentioned it in your book, but the ice core samples that they've taken of these different places that show the whole record of the CO2, and I actually worked in Antarctica, so I...
Really?
Yeah,
wow. Wow.
It was exciting. But,
I'll bet. It takes you like 4 days to get there, right? Yeah, wow.
Like, one of the things is a couple years ago, they can't land planes in December anymore because the ice gets too thin. They actually can't support.
Yeah, on floating ice, right.
Yeah, and to the point where when it's their summer season, they have like this, you know, about a month now where they cannot land planes safely.
A colleague of mine was studying what happens to these giant, like, Rhode Island-sized icebergs that occasionally break off. You know, so they're there and this crack will sort of form over the months and then finally it'll detach. And he was thinking that this thing might actually come into the harbor at McMurdo and sort of really block everything. So he was going to try to leverage that into funding, but that didn't work either.
We do get a lot of, you know, well, the glaciers, there's, you know, things are moving around there a lot.
Yeah, those ice cores are a real treasure trove of paleoclimate information. In addition to little bubbles of air, which if we could get little tiny samples of seawater from 20,000 years ago, it would be totally awesome. But we don't have that. But they do have air samples like that. Plus, lots of other things you can tell about, like the snowfall rate and the temperature and, ice cores and deep sea cores, sediment cores are kind of a backbone of this whole thing. And the models are dicey enough in terms of the climate sensitivity. There's uncertainty because the models can't do clouds the way you would like to do clouds, because clouds are determined by all kinds of little processes, and you just don't have that much resolution in the models. So there's a range of climate sensitivities in the models, about a factor of 2. So doubling CO2 gives you 2 degrees of warming in some models and 4 degrees in other models. And the difference is totally in how they do clouds. So we need paleoclimate things from like ice cores and sediment cores to kind of figure out which of those models is most like the real world. The model itself is not the authoritative source of information. Yeah.
You said that you found the reports about the possibility of accelerated loss of ice sheets in the last year so scary. I want to know a little more about what you mean by scary, because you just talked about your optimism up there on the graphs, and my question is more, what indeed do you find scary about it? And if it is something to be scared about and it happens, then does that change all of your curves to be more accelerated?
It is already happening, and the processes that cause sea level to rise are very slow and will take a long time. So one of the there are two processes that are causing sea level to rise mostly today. One is just the water expanding because it's warming, and it takes like 1,000 years to warm the ocean. And the other is the small mountain glaciers, which have a time scale of, you know, sort of hundreds of years. But what we're looking at is sea level that's like always rising. You can't assume it's going to be at some level and say, okay, there's a 100-year storm, there's a 200-year storm, so we got to build a wall this high. You build a wall this high, and you know that it's going to get flooded in, you know, 50 years or something like that. The effects of sea level were demonstrated by Superstorm Sandy, exacerbated by storms being more intense in a warmer world. But if you also have higher sea level, then, you know, storm surges can reach higher, and like in New York, if it goes higher than the entrance to the subway, it's all over. It goes in to the subway. So sea level and storminess kind of go hand in hand in that way. Sam, you were going to ask something, and I'll come back.
The bubbles in the ice, what's the mechanism that put the bubble there?
The snow falls, and so for maybe 50, 100 meters of depth, the ice is porous. And so there's air
that ice never was water. Was frozen.
It comes down as snow, right.
This
and then finally
liquid water that became frozen. It was always snow.
Right. And then it gets smashed together into ice. And then at some pressure, the bubbles collapse and turn into hydrate, that weird soccer ball-shaped thing that holds gas molecules. But you can get the gas back out from that and analyze, you know, the fraction of CO2 and nitrogen to, you know, measure.
How big are the bubbles?
Well, they go away entirely, but, you know, I don't have any idea. I've never seen. Have you seen that? Did you see bubbles in
the
ice?
I did not actually look at the bubbles.
No,
no.
I think they're pretty small. So they take a little sample of ice and they either melt it in this, you know, vacuum system to get that gases out, or they smash it or something like that. It's not very much gas.
This is a very, really great discussion, but it seems to me like if we're going to be evidence-based, one of the questions is, what's the evidence of that they'll really be able to do the things they're talking about in these international conferences? I mean, on the question of slavery, there may have been wedges, but it took a civil war to get rid of the slavery.
Yeah, that was the hard part.
It didn't really get us all that far in a certain sense.
Well, I could imagine some more environmentally minded country invading us. We're the bad guys. I would welcome them as liberators.
three or four years ago now, the Scientific American did a whole issue on, could you convert completely to solar and wind in 10 years? And they said it was, on your point, that it was technologically feasible, but they said what it would take would be a level of changing up of how you run the world, equivalent to when the U.S. went to World War. All of a sudden, car plants can make tanks.
Yeah, right. Well, the Chinese are.
It happens so slow that the following generations are get used to it.
Yeah, the frog in the water. Yeah. Well, yeah, plus in the amount of climate change that we've seen so far is not actually all that terrible. I mean, there are terrible storms and things that seem really weird and frightening, but on the other hand, there was a study just came out that said most people in the U.S. like the weather better now. You know, this is a terrible cold day, but it's probably a normal day. You know, we just sort of enjoy the warm weather, but, you know, a little bit of warming is not the same thing as a lot of warming. So, but it's kind of a thing that kind of lulls us into letting it go. Yeah.
According to the professor at Harvard, James Anderson, you're familiar
mm-hmm.
with this?
Yeah, name? Yeah. So atmospheric scientist.
The paleo record shows that at 500 parts per million CO2, there's no ice on the poles.
That could be true. It's the CO2 hasn't been as high as 500. For the 800,000 years of when the ice cores is. And I suppose if he's right that there's no ice when it's 500, then you wouldn't find it in an ice core anyway. But so when you go further back than that, it gets a lot dodgier to know what the CO2 was. There are very indirect methods of things that you can measure in soils, but it's...
But if you add up the CO2 equivalents, we're about 490. It's starting to affect what he refers to as the structures which are coupled between the equator and the poles. The ice is a structure. That average temperatures is a misleading way of looking at what's happening, the climate, that it's injecting water into the stratosphere. And that is over North America, particularly. Hmm. And that's leading to the chemical interaction of the chlorine and bromine
yeah.
that are up there from past industrial use.
Mm-hmm.
And starting to break down the ozone layer.
Well, so, freons that we released attacked the ozone. So they made the ozone hole, just like a smoking gun to let us know the chemistry was real.
Down.
But then, you know, it also attacks the ozone everywhere. Although we banned or started to, you know, push back on freons with the Montreal Protocol. So that's actually a success story.
He raises the issue of the addition of moisture to the stratosphere
mm-hmm.
over North America and its effect on agriculture.
Oh, there's many other impacts. There's that the land sort of tends to dry out, get more arid with warming. The storms, you know, like rainfalls get more intense. There's lots of impacts. It's not just sea level. That's totally true. I think drought is the thing that concerns me the most, because if you have a drought that just doesn't let up for 10 years, they start calling that a mega drought. And I mean, you know, we have trucks now. We can drive wheat around or whatever to feed each other better than they could back in the time of the Mayans, for example, but the Mayans were wiped out by mega droughts during the medieval sort of warm time that were droughts that were much bigger than we've experienced, like the Dust Bowl in more recent times. So, yeah, there's lots of impacts. There are many.
I'm wondering if they are integrated into the models.
Some more than others. You know, the dryness, that's not... So there are like 20 different climate models from different kind of national labs and universities around the world. And they all run the same scenarios and post their data on these servers so that people can compare them. And a lot of science is done looking at all these different models to see what they do. And, you know, they do some of the impacts, but others are sort of harder to do, like if a forest, you know, if the Amazon jungle could collapse or something, but that's a very difficult thing to simulate with any kind of, confidence.
So these are highly sophisticated guesses about very complex systems.
How do you get around that? How do you deal with the idea that there's so much natural variability that you can't tease out as a climate change?
Well, one thing to say is that if it was just natural variability, we'd have as many cold records as warm records, but we keep breaking these warm records. So 2015, hottest year on record, and the one hottest before that was 2014. March was the hottest month on record, and the hottest, just this last one, relative to March, and then the next one before that was February. So we keep, you know, busting through these high temperature. You know, for a long time, there's sort of a peak of temperature whenever we have an El Nino event. And so 1998 was a huge El Nino. And so if you look at the temperatures, there was this spike, and then it kind of, you know, went back to kind of this sort of increase. But you would hear a lot of people cherry-picking 1998 and saying, there was a pause. It's not warming anymore. It's a hiatus. And we all knew that was bullshit. And we knew that as soon as the next El Nino came, that would be exposed as bullshit. And that's totally what happened.
Can you speculate on what climate change is contributing to El Nino?
So the El Nino is a state in the Pacific Ocean where you have warm water at the surface, as opposed to La Nina, where it's cold water at the surface by like Peru. And the cold water has lots of nutrients and plankton in it, so that's where the anchovy fisheries are. And so it was Peruvian fishermen who first discovered that some years right around Christmas, there weren't any fish and the water was too warm. And they called it El Nino. So the warm water is normally way off to the west, like Indonesia. And then it's colder over here by Peru. But if you have kind of a bigger pool of warm water, you sort of cover the whole ocean with more warm water, there is a possibility from paleoclimate observations, I think, more than from models, that you could sort of shift toward more El Nino kind of all the time. You know, sort of flopping back and forth between these two stable states, but maybe you spend more time. But I think that's controversial and not really clear. Whether that will happen or not. A lot of the impacts that affect people the most are the kinds of regional climate changes and precipitation changes that are really hard for the models to predict. So, you know, a lot of the, you know, things that are really important to people are things that are kind of hard to know exactly what will happen. You know, like the average temperature is not what clobbers most people. And it's always kind of a local deal. Over here it's drought. Over here we have these storms or it's...
But would you guess that, say, this is such terrible El Nino we're just getting over right now, and there was one in 1998, that is the fact that two terrible El Ninos are coming kind of close together? You speculate that has to do with...
No, it's sort of quasi-periodic, sort of a 4 to 7 year time scale. So the fact that we have periodic El Ninos is not strange at all. What's happening is that just the baseline is warming, so when you poke up with an El Nino, you poke into record territory, but it's the baseline that's changing, not really so much the El Ninos, I think. And actually what I've read is that it's now sinking into sort of a La Nina state, and what that would mean for us here is a hot summer and a cold winter. We'll see if that pans out.
I just wanted to thank you so much, and thank all of you for coming out
on this terrible
evening.
Can
you hang around a little bit?
Yeah, thank you.